For thousands of years, the holy lands of the Middle East have run with blood. Here, the scars of battle fought between three of the great religions of the world are etched into the earth. But the deepest wound was made by a war between Christian and Muslim, begun at the close of the 11th century and fought for 200 years. At stake, a tiny strip of land just a few hundred miles long, but with the greatest prize, Jerusalem. Now this holy war has passed into legend. But there were those who saw it with their own eyes. Great chroniclers from two different worlds, Christian and Muslim, who wrote of great deeds, great battles, great warriors, of men who would lay down their lives for their God. This was the collision of two great faiths, the clash between the Crescent and the Cross. This was the Crusades. Of all the cities in the world, Jerusalem has the most troubled past and the most troubling future. To the Jews, it is the site of the great temples of Herod and Solomon. To Muslims, the place where Muhammad ascended to heaven. To Christians, the place where their Messiah was crucified. After his death, the word of Jesus Christ took root, and Jerusalem slowly shed almost four centuries of Roman occupation to embrace Christian rule. But in the 7th century, the holy city was forcibly seized by a new faith, Islam. Now, 400 years later, the Christians wanted Jerusalem back. Across Europe, some 60,000 warriors were gathering, readying themselves for battle. One of the leaders was veteran warlord Duke Godfrey of Bouillon. He would head up his own army on what would become a three-year crusade across 3,000 miles to reclaim Jerusalem in the name of God. Godfrey was more than just an acclaimed fighter. A generous benefactor of the Catholic Church, he was also an immensely pious man.
As far as I'm concerned, there's one key thing that's driving people to take up the cross. And that is that they actually believe that this crusade is a spiritual war and that it's going to purify their souls of sin. And yes, I'm sure they've got other agendas, they've got other things they're looking for at the same time. But if there's one thing that's at the core and that it's across the largest range of people, it's spirituality, it's religion that's driving this.
The Franks, which was the catch-all word for everyone who participated in the Crusades, were regarded for many centuries until this day as barbarians who came to destroy the peak of Islamic civilization. And this is a very strong thing which goes down right to this day. So the word crusade is electric, and people know it. They know what happened in that world.
There was good reason why men would risk everything to journey to a distant land from which they might never return. Blighted by famine and racked by petty wars, their European homeland was a cursed place. They craved a better life in this world and the next.
I think if you were to take a time machine back to the late 11th century, the first thing that would probably strike you is what a violent society it was. We're at a time when sort of central government's not very well organised, the great monarchies of France and Spain haven't developed. It's petty lordships, local castellans, they raid, they fight, they scrap one another. It's a time of endemic lawlessness.
One of the most learned men in Christendom painted a disturbing portrait of this chaotic world. A senior archbishop and a consort of kings, William of Tyre wrote the history of the Crusades as he saw it.
In nearly all the circle of the earth, belief had failed. The fear of the Lord no longer prevailed among men. Justice had perished from the world. Violence held sway among the nations. Fraud, treachery, and chicanery overshadowed all things. All virtue had departed and ceased to exist as useless. Evil reigned in its stead.
There was only one organization with the potential to stem this anarchy. The church. The Catholic faith dominated 11th century Western Europe.
The world of the Middle Ages was a world that was deeply concerned with matters of religion. And it's almost impossible for us in a secular age today to overestimate how concerned they were. It's almost impossible for us to understand how concerned they were.
People are bombarded with the fact that they are threatened by sin from all forms of life. Just about everything they can do in life is potentially sinful. It's literally as if the air they're breathing is contaminated with sin.
The church could absolve a man of his sins, but it lacked the political muscle to wash away the ills of an entire society. Feuds with the secular rulers of Europe had pushed the papacy to the sidelines until 1088, when a new pope arrived in Rome, Pope Urban II.
Pope Urban was an astute individual, a man who understood the political and social and religious currents and needs of his time, someone who knew how to bring those things together and channel them into productive outlets.
Pope Urban needed a master plan to put the Catholic Church back on the political map. The answer to his prayers would come in the form of a desperate plea for help from an old rival. In 1095, a desperate call for help was dispatched to the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Urban II. Sent from the imperial court of Constantinople, it came from his Eastern Christian rival, the political master of the Greek Orthodox Church, the Byzantine Emperor Alexius I. The power of Alexius's empire was slipping. The influence of his Orthodox Church had once stretched as far as the Holy Land of the Middle East. Islam was now the dominant force in the region. The Seljuk Turks were recent converts to Islam. They had emerged from the steppes of Central Asia and swept down into the Middle East in search of land. Fearsome warriors. Their armies numbered tens of thousands. They seized control of the Muslim territories of Persia, Syria, and Palestine, and finally captured the holy city of Jerusalem. Then they turned their gaze north and stormed their way to the doorstep of the great Byzantine capital, Constantinople.
The status quo, the existing power politics, the power balance of the region was changed. The Byzantines had lost a great area of taxation, of recruitment for troops. They'd lost a lot of prestige as well.
By 1095, the Emperor Alexius was desperate to strike back. But he couldn't do it alone. He appealed to the Pope, in the spirit of Christian brotherhood, to send an elite force of knights to help him keep the Turks at bay. It presented Pope Urban with a perfect opportunity to enhance his political power.
You've got to understand that the popes of that period were politicians. Much more so than they are now. Even now, the current pope intervenes in politics all the time. But at that time, the popes were big players, scheming, manipulating, intriguing, politicking. They were basically the politicians of the church.
Pope Urban was set to hijack the misfortune of the Byzantine Empire. He would launch his own holy war against Islam. A crusade that would strengthen his papacy and put Rome back at the center of the world political stage.
The idea of the crusade satisfies a number of particular agendas for the Pope. It allows him to increase his authority over the knighthood of Western Europe at the expense of other secular rulers. It directs the violent knights away from their practices of brutalizing the church in the West. It also rolls back the infidel. It begins to allow the Christians to reclaim the holy places.
In November 1095, the Pope performed a spellbinding open-air sermon outside the town of Clermont in France. It was a rallying call to princes, knights, clerics, and the common man to wage a war under the banner of the Catholic Church.
Urban must have been a remarkably charismatic and effective speaker. Being at his speech must have been like being at some kind of mass rally, a Billy Graham crusade, a pop concert, something like elements of all of those things together. There were thousands and thousands of people there.
His sermon was a cunningly crafted piece of religious spin, spiced with exaggerated tales of Muslim atrocities against Christian pilgrims living in the Holy Land. It demonized the Turks and presented the crusade as the apocalyptic war of two faiths.
His words seem to proceed from God, were received by young and old alike eagerly as a command from on high. The cradle of our faith, the native land of our Lord and the mother of salvation, is now forcibly held by a people without God. For many years now, the wicked race of Saracens, followers of unclean practices, have oppressed with tyrannical violence the holy places where the feet of our Lord rested. Dogs have entered into the holy places. Priests have been slain in the sanctuaries. Virgins forced to choose between prostitution and death by torture.
The emotional intensity of the moment was very high, and when the end of the speech was reached, Urban gave an appeal, and people came forward from the crowd to take the cross, literally to take strips of cloth and put them on their clothing, over their breast, over their heart, perhaps, and to indicate that they were taking vows and were going to go to the east to rescue their brothers.
Inspired by the possibility of great prestige and honor, tens of thousands of men and women, families, even whole villages took vows to join Pope Urban's crusade. But for many, like the young knight who wrote an eyewitness account of his journey to Jerusalem, there was another attraction, the promise of great riches.
Our Lord, the Pope said, if anyone wished to save their souls, they must not hesitate to undertake with humble spirit the way of the Lord. And if he did not have a great deal of money, divine mercy should provide for him. Then he said, take the road to the Holy Sepulchre. Rescue that land from a dreadful race. Rule over it yourselves, for that land floweth with milk and honey.
Nothing is ever motivated purely by religion or ideology. They knew perfectly well that there was a lot of wealth in that part of the world. It was the center of trade. All the trading caravans pass through this world. And so they wanted part, they wanted the money. It was as simple as that.
But the lure of unimaginable wealth and the chance to seize lands that was said to flow with milk and honey was just the beginning. News soon spread of an even greater incentive. Pope Urban took an unprecedented step. He offered to those who pledged their souls to the crusade a ticket directly to heaven.
To those of you who once fought against brother and relative, now rightfully fight against the barbarians, know then that whoever sets out on this journey, not out of lust for worldly advantage, but only for salvation of his soul and liberation of the church, is remitted in entirety all penance for his sins.
Pope Urban marketed the crusade brilliantly. He struck a number of chords that the knights of Western Europe wanted to hear. He said, look, you're living these violent lives. If you don't atone for your sins, you're going to go to hell. What the crusade offered was a way of carrying on fighting and also receiving a spiritual reward. That was the deal. If you went on crusade, you got the remission of all your sins. You would not go to hell.
The Pope's sermon pushed the boundaries of Christian teaching. In his holy war, a crusader now had the blessing of God to ignore the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill, as long as he was an infidel.
This is violence which God actually wants, and he wants it so much that he's actually going to give a spiritual reward to people who participate in it. It's literally like opening Pandora's box. I'm not sure he's actually conscious of how dangerous an idea he's tampering with at Clermont. But what it leads to is a very powerful upsurge of a sense of hatred of the outsider, if you like, in Western Europe, and a turning against anyone who seems to be other than what is an accepted norm, a Western Christian.
Before the crusade had even left Europe, Christian fanatics swept up by the Pope's words hankered to spill blood. To these fundamentalists, any non-Christian was an infidel. And the infidels were all around.
But the pilgrims rose up in a spirit of cruelty against the Jews. They inflicted a most cruel slaughter on them, claiming that the killings would be of service against the enemies of Christianity. Attacked them, decapitated many. They destroyed their homes and synagogues, and even divided all the looted money amongst themselves.
Across Europe, thousands of Jews were massacred in the name of God. Murder and slaughter of the innocent had become the hallmarks of the First Crusade. In the autumn of 1096, almost a year after the Pope's sermon, armies from France, Germany, and Italy set out on the epic 3,000-mile march to aid their Christian brothers and liberate the Holy Land from Muslim rule. At the helm of the largest army from Northern Europe was Duke Godfrey of Bouillon.
Godfrey was one of the senior leaders of the First Crusade. He was a very pious man. In fact, we know that he brought a number of monks with him on the expedition to help him in his daily prayers. He was also a great warrior. He'd won repute before the crusade for his feats in single combat, and he was a respected man who the leaders of the expedition felt they could all deal with.
At Godfrey's side was his younger brother Baldwin, the Count of Boulogne. Ruthless to the core, Baldwin had once been destined for the priesthood, but had turned instead to a love of women and war.
Writers talk about him being plagued by lust and the sins of the flesh.
You said to be quite discreet about all of this, but it is an aspect of his character. He's also a very pragmatic man, and somebody who would not hesitate to brush aside others if they crossed him.
Following in the footsteps of Duke Godfrey and Count Baldwin, military historian John France uses 11th century sources as his guidebook. These medieval records reveal the harsh realities of life on crusade.
To take the cross must have been very, very expensive. We know that people sold land, we know that they mortgaged land. They seem to have tried to raise about 6 years' income just to live through the crusade. A rich man would have had a whole retinue. He'd have come, you know, with his household, with everybody who would normally accompany him. And possibly wives. It's often forgotten that many wives came with their husbands because they too were inspired by this remarkable opportunity for salvation. So what you have on the crusade is a sort of city, as a whole society, moving eastwards towards Jerusalem. The problems of feeding that are absolutely immense. I mean, it is almost inconceivable how they did it. We would guess that they stole stuff, but fundamentally they were probably buying from the local peasants, who would be glad to sell, but at very high prices.
For almost 6 months, Godfrey's Crusader army lumbered across thousands of miles over the rivers and mountain ranges of Eastern Europe. They finally joined forces with other Christian armies from the south at the agreed rendezvous point, the spiritual heart of Eastern Christianity, Constantinople. Constantinople is today known as Istanbul, the bustling showpiece of modern Turkey, and a largely Muslim city. But 900 years ago, perched on the most easterly tip of Europe, it was the last Christian city before the Crusade ventured across the Bosphorus into enemy territory. Then, the jewel of the city was the great Orthodox Christian cathedral of Saint Sophia. Covered in mosaics of burnished gold, it was a vivid testament to the legendary wealth of Constantinople. But the Crusaders would scarcely get a glimpse of it. The Byzantine capital was surrounded by two concentric rings of thick stone wall, more than 10 miles round and 30 feet high. To friends of his realm, the emperor would throw open the triumphal gates and usher them into the heart of his city. But to the mass of crusaders, they remained firmly closed.
Well, here are the remains of the magnificent Golden Gate, one of the 10 entrances to the city of Constantinople. This was originally a triumphal arch. You can see the three elements of the arch here. It reminds one a little bit of the Arc de Triomphe. Atop this structure, you would have had four bronze elephants, and around it, there would have been a series of friezes depicting the deeds of the classical heroes of antiquity. When the Crusaders arrived out here, these doors would have been shining and dazzling, and of course closed before them.
The gates had been sealed on direct orders of the Emperor Alexius. He was furious. A Catholic army of 60,000 was not what he had in mind when he asked Pope Urban to send an elite team of mercenaries.
What he required was a group of about 300 knights, well-trained, well-armed, that he could direct where he felt the threat was greatest. What he got was something completely different, something that he did not remotely, in his wildest dreams, expect to receive. Tens of thousands of fanatical, armed men who descended upon him like a series of pests, locusts coming down, in fact, is how one chronicler describes it. And they came down and they approached his great city, wave after wave after wave.
The swarm of soldiers sent by his rival, the Pope, and now camping outside the gates, was large enough to mount an attack on the city. He couldn't afford to offend them. But Alexius could see a way to manipulate events to his own advantage.
The Emperor Alexius was a wicked and crafty man. He played the part of a scorpion, which when met face to face is harmless, but the tail of which is barbed with a poisonous sting, it is well to avoid.
The Emperor invited the principal commanders of the Crusade into his lair, the inner sanctum of the Imperial Palace. Alexius was confident he could win over Duke Godfrey and his brother Baldwin. But they had now been joined by another Crusade commander. Bohemond of Taranto was the aggressive eldest son of a family of Norman mercenaries who had recently taken control of southern Italy.
He was somebody who attracted attention through his appearance and through his bearing. He was perhaps the greatest warrior of the whole expedition. He was said to have the ferocity of a lion, a starving lion, charging into a group of sheep.
Bohemond's experience in war was invaluable. He had already battled against the Muslims in Sicily and won. But for years, he had also been fighting with the Byzantines. But Bohemond, like the other Crusader leaders, was a better soldier than a politician. They were all about to be outwitted.
When the Emperor heard that Bohemond, that most distinguished man, had arrived, he ordered for him to be received with proper ceremony. Then, once he'd settled in, with the Duke Godfrey and his brother Baldwin, he invited him to a secret conference. He planned how to entrap these Christian knights by fraud and cunning.
Alexius had lost much of his empire to the Turks. He wanted to win these lands back, not see them passed on to this rival Catholic army. The Emperor still had one trump card up his sleeve.
When they are in his lands, the one thing that they need is food. They're an army that is unprepared. It doesn't have supply chains like modern armies do. It's not all planned out ahead. They've got to live off the land. So Alexius can control and give them markets if they play the game. If they don't play the game with him, then he can withdraw those markets and they are going to start suffering quite badly. It may provoke an outburst of bad behaviour from them. They might start trying to ravage the land, but they realise sooner or later, because he has all the food, they've got to start doing business with Alexius. He knows that and they know it too.
In return for his promise to supply food, each of the three Crusader leaders was forced to swear an oath of allegiance to the Emperor. By that oath, they granted Alexius a commanding role over the whole campaign and vowed to return to his empire and the Eastern Orthodox Church any lands that they might win back from the Turks. The entire Crusader army was ferried across the Bosphorus by their new partners, the Byzantines. Soon they would be in enemy territory for the first time, and this fragile alliance would be put to the test. With Constantinople behind them, the Crusaders still had over 1,000 miles of hostile territory to cross before they reached Jerusalem. After only a few weeks, in May 1097, they reached the first enemy-held city. Nicaea, today known as Iznik, had once been a Byzantine city. But 20 years earlier, it had been seized by Turkish warlords and was now the fortress capital of the new sultan, Kilij Arslan.
Over the northern hills is where the Crusader army came from. They marched down from Constantinople over the hills and fanned out round the city, clamping it in an iron siege. Finally, the moment of conflict. And they must have been pretty excited, pretty hepped up. This was the enemy. This is where it's all going to start.
Breaking their way into Nicaea would not be easy. A thick 3-mile-long wall enclosed three sides of the city.
attacking a city like this is really pretty difficult because these walls are very formidable. You can see them here, 10 meters high roughly, the towers here 30 meters apart. That means whatever way you approach the wall, people have got you in their sights as a very good, very easy target.
For 6 weeks, the Crusaders besieged Nicaea. The fighting was intense, but morale in the Christian camp was high. They were on the verge of their first victory. Though the Crusaders had promised to return the city to the Byzantine Emperor Alexis' control, they expected to keep the riches of Nicaea for themselves. But their Byzantine allies were about to pull the rug from under their feet. Along the western flank of the city lay the great Ascanian Lake. Here, early on June 18th, 1097, emissaries of the Byzantine Emperor initiated a secret plan to take the city and its spoils for themselves.
The Byzantines had brought their ships onto the lake to help in the siege, but they used their ships for a quite different purpose. They secretly contacted the Turks within the city. They would much sooner surrender peacefully to the Byzantines than be chopped up into little pieces by the Crusaders, who were obviously thirsting for their blood. And when morning breaks, there on the battlements of the city are the imperial flags flying. The city has surrendered.
The sight of the Byzantine imperial banner flying above the city ramparts incensed the Crusader army. They had been double-crossed by their so-called Christian brother, Emperor Alexius.
When Alexius did that deal with the Turks and took Nicaea for himself, the Crusader army felt utterly betrayed. They were furious. The man who they trusted, who was supposed to be their ally, who they would have to trust on the future fights through Turkey and into the Holy Land, had gone behind their backs. This was a very, very bad sign for the future of the Byzantine Crusader alliance.
Robbed of the spoils of Nicaea, the Crusaders packed up their camp and ventured deeper into enemy territory, heading towards Jerusalem. But they were not alone. From the hills, the Turkish Sultan Kilij Arslan shadowed their every step. He had just lost his fortress city. Now, he wanted revenge.
Kilij Arslan, mindful of the injury done him, constantly brooded over the fact that through the Christians he had lost the excellent city of Nicaea. With all his heart, he yearned to retaliate and determined to lay an ambush for his enemy.
The Turkish leader would unleash the full might of his fighting force, more than 50,000 men. Scouting the land just ahead of the Crusader army, he found the perfect site for a surprise attack. The epic clash that took place here has become part of Crusader lore. It is known as the Battle of Dorylaeum. Though many have tried, to date, no one has found the real battle site. But John Franz has spent years sifting for clues and now thinks he can pinpoint its exact location.
We know certain things about this battle, but finding it is a different matter. We know that it took place at a junction of two valleys. We know there was a marsh, but the thing that we really know is that this junction of two valleys must have provided an immense amount of space, because at one stage both armies deployed in full battle array, and that takes a lot of room.
Professor Franz is taking the same road used by the Crusaders in 1097. Back then, it was so narrow they could only travel five abreast. With 60,000 men,
The procession took 3 days to pass any given point. As a result, a vanguard of 20,000 men led by Bohemund became separated from the main body of the army. They ended up camping alone and vulnerable in the very valley chosen by Kilidge Arslan for his ambush.
This is really getting very flat and open. I think this looks like a place where two valleys meet. In fact, it really looks like a place where two valleys meet.
35 miles from Nicaea, John France reveals for the first time the long-lost site of the Battle of Dorylaeum, the first major battle of the Crusades.
This really is it. You've got to take away all the modern earthworks, this road. This is a flat plain at the junction of two valleys. It fits all the pictures. It's even slightly damp underfoot. This is it. This is where the battle took place, and we're standing on one of the really decisive battlefields of the crusading era.
At dawn on July 1st, 1097, tens of thousands of Turks mounted a head-on attack against Bohemund's vanguard force camped alone on the valley bed. At last, on the real battle site, Professor Franz can see exactly how the epic struggle unfolded.
They were all mashed up in the camp, here by the jeep, desperately trying to get their defenses up, and charging up at them, up the valley floor, are the Turks.
For one man who fought at Dorylaeum, it was a day he would never forget.
Bohemund said to his men, "Gentlemen, brave soldiers of Christ, you can see that we are encircled and that a hard battle lies ahead. Therefore, let all knights go out like men and meet the enemy."
With the Turks streaming through the camp, the Crusaders were pinned down. No matter how many Turks they killed, they were losing more men. As wave after wave of Turkish cavalry swept towards them, they now faced a style of warfare they never encountered before. These were no ordinary riders. These were archers mounted on horseback.
The Seljuk Turks were really first-class archers and very courageous. They attacked very quickly. They're very light, unlike the Western European knights. They have smaller horses, they don't carry too much armor. They were really clever in shooting arrows from the back of the horse, riding at a very fast speed.
This startling new tactic was decimating Bohemund's vanguard force of 20,000 men. But mounted archers were not the only surprise the Turks had in store.
The Turks surrounded us on all sides, throwing darts, casting javelins, and shooting arrows from an astonishing range.
Just how the Turks fired from so far away has never been understood. But buried away in a little-known Muslim text of the time, Dr. Taif Al-Azhari has discovered an obscure reference written in ancient Arabic that may solve the mystery. The Nawqiya.
The Nawqiya were a battalion inside the Turkish army of Arab foot soldiers. The soldier lay down with his back to the ground and he used a huge bow with both muscles of his legs and fired a couple of hundred meters away. Sometimes in the sources we have stories like the sunlight disappeared for a couple of seconds because of the number, sheer number of the arrows.
Bohemund had already lost some 4,000 men. And now, the Turks were closing in for the kill. Desperately, he ordered his men to hold the lines around the camp. But from beyond the valley, help was at hand.
Greater part of the army, under those illustrious and splendid men, Duke Godfrey, his brother Baldwin, and other warriors devoted to God, was advancing swiftly to the aid of their brethren.
With the armies of Godfrey and Baldwin pouring into the valley, the Crusader force swelled to 55,000 men.
The Turks found themselves, potentially at least, between an anvil and a hammer. And rather than face that, they broke and fled, very sensibly.
The sheer number of the combined Crusader force had overwhelmed the Turks.
But it has to be said, the Turks fought brilliantly. Who would ever have praised so much the Turks, said one of the Crusaders, who were such fine soldiers, and had they been but Christians, would have been the equal of us.
The Crusaders believed they were now invincible. One confidently wrote home to his wife to say they should all be at the gates of Jerusalem in just 5 weeks. He couldn't have been more wrong. In just over a month, he would still be hundreds of miles from the Holy City, and hundreds more would be dead. Not from battle, but from the perils of the journey itself. The Crusaders had successfully defeated the Turkish army of Kilic Arslan at Dorylaeum. But their leaders feared another ambush. Instead of following the most direct route to the Holy Land, they opted for a more circuitous path that would take the whole procession across the Anti-Taurus Mountains. A few years later, one young knight recalled the perilous journey.
We began to cross a damnable mountain, which was so high and steep that none of our soldiers dared to overtake one another on the mountain path. Horses fell over the precipice, and one beast of burden dragged another down.
Compelled to travel in single file, it took them 3 weeks to cross the mountains. And the worst was yet to come. Already exhausted, they headed down onto the arid plains of Pisidia and 90-degree heat.
The land was deserted, waterless and uninhabitable. We suffered greatly from hunger and thirst and found nothing at all to eat.
More than 500 of both sexes died at this time, prostrated by suffering. Most serious of all, their trusty steeds, companions in battle, on whom their masters depended for their own safety, and whose glory should be seen in prancing hoof and gleaming teeth, gave way like common beasts of burden.
After months of this torturous journey, there was one notable casualty. Gotthilda, the wife of one of the chief commanders of the Crusade. Baldwin, the Count of Bologna.
Gotthilda was a very, very wealthy woman. She would have held estates and had finances that Baldwin, as her husband, would have had a route into. If she died, these would go back to her family. He wouldn't have access to her. They would stay with her bloodline. Her death means that his chances of becoming rich when he went back home had gone. his mindset would change. He was now potentially on the lookout for lands, for territory, for wealth of his own. Within a day or so of her death, his policy became one of acquisition and greed.
The chroniclers make no mention of his grief. Only that Baldwin took a few hundred knights and left the main army on a solo mission. If he was to make up for the loss of his wife's wealth, the easiest course would be to seize a city of his own. 100 miles to the east was the perfect target. Edessa.
Edessa is a wealthy city. It generates its own income through metalwork. It's a very fertile region. It's very close to the Euphrates River. It's also on the trade routes. So you've got spices and luxury cloths coming across from the east, passing through it, and then going to the Mediterranean for further trade. It's a really, really good spot for Baldwin to base himself.
The problem for Baldwin was that Edessa was not in Muslim hands. It was a Christian city that had held out against the Turks. But the people of Edessa had grown weary of constant attacks by the Muslims. When news spread that a great Crusader prince was close by, the citizens pleaded with their governor, Thoros, to invite Baldwin to come to their aid.
The governor of the city was a Christian Armenian called Thoros. He was a feeble old man, without child of either sex. He was a useless overlord. He was unable to protect his citizens from wrongs or to procure them relief from the dangers of attack from these cursed infidels.
Baldwin's help would come at a price. He would protect Edessa from the Turks in return for the keys to the city. Thoros naively promised to make Baldwin the new ruler, but only after his death. The old man then sealed his own fate by adopting Baldwin as his son. For Baldwin, Thoros' death would not come soon enough.
Baldwin discovered evil counselors in Edessa. Traitors who plotted with him to have Thoros murdered and who promised to hand Edessa over to him.
Thoros realized too late that he had been deceived. He ran for his life.
He took a rope and let it down from the tower. But immediately his destroyers shot him down into the middle of the street. Cutting off his head, they carried it on a spear through the quarters of the city for everyone to mock.
It's not a good start for crusading ideology, it has to be said. This is not a great moment in the idea that Christianity is going to come to save Eastern Christendom from the threat of Islam. The reality is that Baldwin has come with an eye to gaining territory, and I think he's prepared to remove physically and politically a figure who's Christian from power to get his own territory.
If there had been no Islam in that world, but you had had Eastern Christianity, which you had, after all, before the rise of Islam, exactly the same thing would have happened, but they would have had to find a different ideological colouring for it. They probably would have said, these are not proper Christians, we're the true Christians, like religious fundamentalists of all hues say. So, from that point of view, many Christians in that region also regarded the Crusaders as essentially Christian fundamentalist barbarians from the uncivilized lands of the north.
As Baldwin celebrated his successful takeover of Edessa, 150 miles to the southwest, the main Crusader army arrived at the great walled city of Antioch. Since the time of the Apostle St. Peter, it had become a thriving Christian city. But in 1085, the Turks had seized control. This would be a prize second only to Jerusalem. A prize worth dying for. The splendor of Antioch is hard to see today. The once majestic city now lies in ruins in the hill country of eastern Turkey. But for one knight, who after a year on crusade caught his first glimpse of the ancient capital in 1097, it was awe-inspiring.
The city is surrounded by two walls, one of which is very high and amazingly broad. It's built with huge stones, and there are set up on it 450 towers. It's shut in by four mountains, and alongside the city walls runs a deep river. And everything about the city is beautiful.
I think the Crusaders want to take the city for a whole range of reasons. First and probably foremost is strategic. Antioch is literally the gateway to Syria and the gateway to the Holy Land. If they leave the city behind them, their route for escape and certainly their route for resupply and reinforcement is going to be cut off. Spiritually, it's almost the equal of Jerusalem in many ways as a goal, because Antioch was, in Christian tradition, the site of the founding of the very, very first Christian church by St. Peter, the Apostle of Christ. So this gave it a real spiritual power and a spiritual cachet that I think the Crusaders were very empowered by.
The majority of Antioch's inhabitants were Armenian and Greek Orthodox Christians. Their Turkish rulers granted them total freedom to worship. But this was not enough for the Crusaders outside the city walls. They wanted to remove the Turks from power and return the city to Christian rule. But taking it back wouldn't be easy.
Antioch is a very well-defended city indeed. The walls surrounding the city, here high on the mountain, going down to the plain, are very massive. You can see that, the construction here. A strong, stout, thick inner core, faced with this fine exterior. Reinforced, of course, with a system of towers. The towers interlock with one another. This is the kind of wall you don't shift with a battering ram.
The Christian chroniclers weren't alone in recording the tale of the bloody struggle for Antioch. Ibn al-Athir traveled far and wide, collecting tales of the great Muslim heroes who resisted the Crusaders, the Franks, as he called them. His celebrated history tells of the spirited Turkish leader of Antioch, Yagi Shihan.
Yagi Shihan, the ruler of Antioch, showed unparalleled wisdom and courage, strength and judgment. If all the Franks who died attacking his city had survived, they would have overrun all the lands of Islam.
Ibn al-Athir would recount how Yagi Shihan, a man fabled for his big hairy ears and thick gray beard, did his utmost to keep the enemy out. But he knew any of the local Christians might be persuaded to let the Franks in.
When he heard the approach of the Franks, he was not sure how the Christian people of the city would react. So he sent all the Muslims outside the city walls to dig trenches. And the next day, he sent the Christians by themselves to do the same task. When they were ready to return home at the end of the day, he refused to allow them in. Antioch is yours, he said. But you have to leave it to me until I find out what happens between us and the Franks.
Yagi Shihan believed he had made Antioch unassailable. He then turned his attention to the Crusader army amassing outside his city walls.
Yagi Shihan is praised by all the sources about his good organization of the defense, night and day, night shifts, night guards, throwing oil at the Crusaders, depriving them from food supplies, sending guards during the night to attack their camps, burn some of their tents, depriving them of water supplies. He really confronted the Crusaders alone, and he fought vigorously to defend his city.
His efforts paid off. After 8 arduous months, the Crusaders were no closer to getting in, and conditions in the camp were utterly desperate. Food had always been scarce, and they had the expelled Christians to feed as well. As the siege dragged on, the Crusaders had virtually nothing left to eat. The Christian chronicler William of Tyre told how the Crusaders were forced to drain blood from their own horses and drink it.
Day by day, the shortage of provisions continued and the famine grew. And as a result, a pestilence broke out among the legions in the camp, so fatal that there was now scarcely room to bury the dead. With the loss of those who had wasted away through hunger and disease, and of others who had perished by the sword, the army had diminished to such an extent, it seemed as if barely half our numbers had survived.
The suffering of the Crusaders was about to get worse. In a medieval Islamic text, Dr. Taif al-Azari has discovered how the leader of Antioch, Yaghi Shihan, was able to summon reinforcements right under the nose of the Crusaders.
The answer was this, a pigeon. The Seljuk Turks were the first one to invent the postal service, kind of DHL of today. They will attach a message to the bird's leg and set it free. In a matter of hours, the message will come across and the help will arrive from anywhere in the Muslim world.
Two months later, Christian scouts reported that a massive Turkish army was on its way. The Crusaders had no time. They needed to break into the city quickly. It was Bohemund who found the weak spot in the city's defenses, a traitor in the Muslim ranks.
He was an armorer, a maker of breastplates named Firuz. He worked at the tower that stood over the riverbed where the water flowed from the city into the valley. He had long served the ruler of Antioch, Yaghi Shihan. But he sealed a pact with the Franks. They bribed him with a fortune in money and lands.
Firuz was the commander not only of one tower, but of 3 towers. Bohemund really hit gold dust. For whatever reason, he was ready to betray the city. And as so often happens, it was betrayal that let the enemy in, not a storming of the city.
All the preparations were made. Towards dawn, the knights and the foot soldiers began to approach the towers of which Firuz was warden.
And our captain Bohemund said to us, "Go on, strong in heart and lucky in your comrades, and scale the ladders into Antioch, for by God's will, this city shall be in our power in a trice."
What I'm looking for is what I've always wanted to find, which is Firuz's tower. Now, this is the foundation of a major tower, right on the angle of the wall where it plunges down to the south defences. And I don't think there can be anywhere else that this can be, except the Tower of Firuz. The Crusaders had plenty of cover. They came up the hill beyond here, massed over this shelf. Firuz leaned over the wall and he swung a lantern.
We took the ladders and lashed them to the battlements of the city. An amazing number of men began to climb.
Then, of course, disaster. The ladder broke.
It was too late to turn back now. More Crusaders were scrambling up the remaining ladders into Firouz's tower. Within minutes, they were streaming down the battlements into the city and opening the gates for the rest of the knights waiting outside.
They flung the gateway open, and the men funneled into the city.
Months of starvation and disease left the Crusaders in no mood for mercy. Guided by the local Christians of Antioch, they flushed the Muslims out from their homes, the city streets, and the mosques, and killed them indiscriminately.
The shrieks of countless people rose, making a terrifying noise throughout the city. But Beaumont did not waste any time on this account and ordered his glorious banner to be carried and set up on top of a wall opposite the citadel. Every street on every side was full of corpses, so that no one could endure to be there because of the stench. Nor could they walk along the narrow paths of the city, except over the bodies of the dead.
Everyone really was really massacred, was killed. The Jews, the Christians, the Muslims, and then sparingly children or women or elderly, and they were really avenging and proving that they are really superior and they are the true and new master to the territory.
The one inhabitant of Antioch the Crusaders didn't manage to find was its Turkish ruler, Yagi Shihan. He managed to escape.
Yagi Shihan was told they had taken the citadel. Panic seized him, and he opened the gates and fled with an escort of 30 pages. When he recovered his self-control, he repented having rushed to safety instead of staying there and fighting to the death. He started groaning and weeping. When he was at his last gasp, a shepherd passed by, killed him, cut off his head, and took it to the Franks at Antioch.
Yagi Sheehan's head on a stick was small consolation. Bohemond had much more to worry about. Yagi Sheehan's message had gotten through. The day after his execution, the Turkish reinforcements finally arrived. The Christian besiegers would now become the besieged. In June 1098, after an 8-month siege, the Crusaders had finally taken the ancient city of Antioch. Ironically, they had traded places with their enemy. The Christians were now the ones imprisoned behind its walls. The Turks, on the outside, ready to besiege.
This is a pretty desperate situation. Morale is rock bottom. Everybody is frightened, and quite reasonably so. They look as though they're dead. And in this desperate situation, the basic motivation of the Crusaders comes out. Their belief, the belief of the leading members, that somehow God is on their side.
Benedicat vos omnipotens Deus, Pater et Filius et Spiritus Sanctus. Amen.
The Crusaders prayed for a miracle, and they got one. News spread that God had sent word to a Crusader in a vision.
Well, we have to distinguish visions from imaginations. A real vision comes from God, actually. Yeah, it is the work of the Holy Spirit.
The Crusader was only a lowly priest from France, but his vision would inspire an entire army.
He was a pilgrim by the name of Peter Bartholomew.
One night, so he said, St. Andrew the Apostle appeared to him and said, "Know, my son, that if you go to the church of the Blessed Peter in the city of Antioch, there you shall find the Holy Lance, the spear with which our Savior Jesus Christ was pierced when he was hanging on the cross." And he swore that the whole story was true.
The real spear that pierced Christ's side has not been seen in centuries. To find the Holy Lance now, at a time of deep crisis, would be to establish a powerful connection between the Crusaders and Christ.
There can't be real relics of Christ because Jesus rose from the dead and he went up to his Father in heaven. So there are no remains. So it cannot be. Only what has touched him, or what he has touched, like the cross or the Holy Lance.
It's very significant that he seizes upon the idea of a simple relic, nothing complex, a simple relic, a signal from God that everybody can focus on, that is unarguable, undisputable. It isn't a story, it isn't just a vision, it's a solid metal token of God's will.
Peter Bartholomew handpicked his own band of 12 disciples and dashed to the small church to dig up the floor, where he claimed the Holy Lance was buried. After a day and night of frantic digging, hope had begun to fail. But Peter himself leaped into the pit inside the church and pulled out a piece of rusty metal. He claimed he had found the elusive Holy Lance, a claim Arab historians have ridiculed.
The holy man who proclaimed that the Messiah had a lance buried in the church was an extremely wily monk. He told them all, if you find it, you'll be victorious. Otherwise, you'll face a certain death. But before saying this, he went and buried the lance in the soil under the church. And then he covered his tracks.
The holy relics is a very interesting thing, because as the crusading armies went, the number of holy relics multiplied. And people who wanted to make the equivalent of a quick buck went and found more and more holy relics. As to what these objects really were is, you know, one can imagine anything. But the fact that they needed them shows that these holy relics became a primitive form of propaganda.
It's a matter of faith, what I say now. There are people with special gift from God who can distinguish in holy things and also in relics, which can say this is authentic, the other thing is not authentic. So, but it's a matter of faith.
The people in the army recovered their morale, their fighting will. This is a moment of violent religious exaltation. The mood in the army changes, aggression replaces defeatism. This is an army ready to fight.
Six lines of battle were drawn up by those of us inside the city. We closed our ranks and, protected by the sign of the cross, we went out by the gate. When the Turks saw our squadrons so well drawn up, coming out one after the other, they said, "Let them come, so that we may have them the more surely in our power." But once we were all outside, and the Turks saw how great was the force of the Franks, oh, they were much afraid.
The Crusaders had just 200 horses left, but they still rode out to face the Turks head on, the Holy Lance held high. One eyewitness spoke of yet another vision. An army of spirits sent by God.
Then appeared a countless host of men on white horses, whose banners were all white. When our men saw this, they did not understand what was happening or who these men might be, until they realized this was the blessed help sent by Christ. The Turks fled in terror, and with God's help we defeated them.
Whether the visions were real or just an elaborate hoax to boost morale, the city of Antioch was once again in Christian hands. But it would never be returned to the control of the Eastern Church of the Byzantine Emperor. Bohemond reneged on the promise he had made to Alexius a year before and crowned himself Prince of Antioch.
When Bohemond decided to hold on to Antioch, he had completely broken his promise to Alexius. The idea that he would return lands that he conquered to the Byzantine emperor was in tatters. He had also fractured and destroyed one of the basic ideas, one of the pillars, the catalyst of the First Crusade. The idea of Pope Urban that the Western Church would work with the Byzantines to defeat the Muslims of the Near East was no longer sustainable.
Great swathes of territory were now in Crusader hands. Baldwin controlled all the land around Edessa, and Bohemond, the territory around Antioch. Both were now very rich men. By the end of 1098, as the leaders became increasingly consumed by running their new principalities, they began to stall on whether to continue the march on to Jerusalem.
There are huge arguments right across the range of the leaders, all the way through different levels of the army, about where the crusade should go next. Should they immediately try to march on Jerusalem? Should they recover their strength? How long should they wait? What route should they take? And the potential is for the army to literally just fall apart, to go into different directions, for people to start returning home, to lose their impetus entirely. And it comes very close to this.
As the crusade leaders squabbled, the troops demanded that the army march southward to Jerusalem. To them, the true goal of the crusade had been forgotten. Their anger and frustration finally boiled over in a small town 2 days' ride from Antioch, called Marat al-Numan.
So this is where the legacy of the First Crusade really took place. I think it's a landmark for any historian to visit this place. This is where the First Crusader really made their violent legacy.
It would be here the Christians would commit the most evil atrocity of the Crusade. This is Dr. Taif Al-Azhari's first visit to Marat al-Numan, the site of the most shocking atrocity of the First Crusade. Tucked away in the northwest corner of Syria, this 11th century citadel has been all but forgotten. Its ruins are now little more than a playground to the children who emerge to shadow his tour.
I think we are really making our way into the citadel of Marat, and to the left, the remains of the mosque, and to the right hand, the remain of the little palace for the ruler of the city. Probably this was a church serving the Christian population of Marathon and Oman, who were living peacefully side by side with their fellow Muslims. And of course, the Crusaders were really indiscriminate about killing all the inhabitants of Marra, regardless of their faith or their religion.
As the Crusaders consolidated their hold on the land around Antioch, a small contingent arrived here in November 1098 under the leadership of Bohemond.
We came to the city named Marat, not far off, in which many Turks and Saracens lived. Bohemond sent an interpreter to the Saracen leaders to tell them if they, with their wives and children and goods, would take refuge in a palace just above the city gates, he would spare them from death. All our men entered the gates. Each of them seized his own share of whatever goods he could find in all the houses and cellars. And towards dawn, everybody was killed.
بعدين فجأة ها في عام 1099 ظهر جيش أوروبي جاي من فرنسا من إيطاليا. The sources really tell us about the suffering for all the inhabitants. Some of them were really lit in fire and people were really just fried inside, burned alive inside. Some managed to escape. Of course, they cannot really escape the butchery of the Crusaders, decapitated or knifed 1,000 times. 20,000, 25,000 were really massacred inside the town. Not only the Muslims were massacred, also Christians as well. Not only soldiers, but also children, elderly women met their violent fate. So it was really a war crime place, kind of an ethnic cleansing.
Treachery, followed by massacre, had become the calling cards of the Crusader army. But as Christian witnesses revealed, it was what happened after the killing finally stopped that sets the story of Marat al-Numan apart.
The Franks stayed in the city for 1 month and 4 days. And while we were there, some of our men could not satisfy their needs. Either because we were there too long, or because they were so hungry, for there was no plunder to be had outside the city walls. So they ripped up the bodies of the dead, and others cut the dead flesh into slices and cooked it to eat. Our troops boiled pagan adults in cooking pots. They impaled children on spits to devour their flesh.
There is no such thing as a spiritual war. When you fight a war, the aim of that war is to defeat your enemy. They involve violence, they involve threats, they involve propaganda, and they involve, let's put it like this, shock and awe. And the eating of human flesh was designed to strike fear in the heart of the enemy. Here we are strong, we are tough, and if necessary, we'll eat you up alive. And to a certain extent, that succeeded. I mean, there was a wave of horror and fear. They eat us, and if they're eating us dead tomorrow, they might eat us alive.
To the leaders of the Crusade, the barbarity that took place at Marat proved that their troops wouldn't tolerate any more delays. The time had come to fulfill their vows and seize the city that had inspired them to risk everything in the name of God. It made no difference that Jerusalem had recently fallen into the control of a far more conciliatory Muslim power. the Fatimids of Egypt, and that they were calling for peace. In June 1099, 13,000 crusaders, less than a quarter of the number that had originally set out from Europe, arrived at the gates of the city where Jesus Christ had died.
When the crusaders reached the walls of Jerusalem, they finally arrived at their goal. After 3 years, 3,000 miles marching, the most incredible suffering, terrible, terrible losses, they'd arrived at the holy city. Some were so overwhelmed with emotion they wept, others prostrated themselves on the ground. But now, of course, the hardest task of all faced them. They had to break in.
After 3 years of fighting, the Crusader army prepared to attack Jerusalem. The walls were 50 feet high and 10 feet thick. To scale them, they would need ladders and siege towers. But the Muslim defenders had razed the entire surrounding area of trees. The Christians sent out foraging parties to scavenge for wood. Hidden in a hole in the ground, they found 400 pieces of ready-prepared timber. It seemed, once again, God was giving them a helping hand. It was enough timber to build two 50-foot siege towers with which to attack the walls of Jerusalem. Everything was in place for the final showdown. On the 14th of July, 1099, the Crusaders launched a two-pronged assault. Two siege towers were rolled into place, one to the northwest and the other to the south of the city. The Muslim defenders knew if just one tower breached the walls, Jerusalem would fall.
You can look up at these walls and imagine missiles, stones, arrows raining down upon you. The fighting was barbaric and intense. And at one point, the Crusaders gave the phrase live ammunition its literal meaning. They captured a Muslim, strapped him to a catapult, and fired him back over the walls.
To the south, the Muslims pelted the first siege tower with pots of oil and flaming bolts, until finally it went up in flames. Now, only one siege tower was left, to the northwest of the city, under the command of the revered Crusader general, Duke Godfrey.
Godfrey decided upon a change of plan. I've got here an eyewitness account written by a man called Raymond of Aguillé. This is what he said. Godfrey moved to a position between the Church of the Blessed Stephen and the Valley of Josaphat.
Godfrey's plan was inspired. He had found the weak spot in the Muslim fortifications, but it was over a mile round to the northeast of the city. In the course of just a few hours, and under the cover of darkness, he had his men wheel the whole siege tower to the less defended part of the wall.
Here we are, the spot that the Crusaders broke into Jerusalem.
The Muslims mounted one last-ditch attempt to destroy Godfrey's siege tower.
They used grappling irons to try and snare the tower, to use the hooks to catch the wood, and then, remarkably, to pull the thing over. To counter this, the Crusaders had an enormous scythe made that would cut through these ropes. At one moment, there was a brief fire there up on the walls. Godfrey saw this and lowered a makeshift bridge from his tower onto the battlements.
The walls were breached, and the Muslim defenders ran for their lives. The Christians at last could seize the holy city of Jerusalem.
We chased the Saracens, and killing them all the way up to Solomon's temple. Before long, its walls were streaming with blood. We killed both men and women, cutting off their heads with our drawn swords. The surviving Saracens dragged the dead bodies out in front of the city gates and piled them up in mounds as high as houses. No one has ever seen or heard such slaughter of pagans. For they burnt them on pyres as high as pyramids. No one knew how many there were. Except God. Jerusalem is ours.
The fact that against all the odds, seemingly in a miracle, this crusade took Jerusalem and achieved what it had set out to do, that seemed a very clear indication that God's hand was at work, and that its participants and all of Western Europe suddenly thought, this is true. God really does want a crusade to happen. God really is behind this venture.
Almost 3 years after he left his homeland in Northern Europe, Duke Godfrey would become the new Christian ruler of Jerusalem. Humbly, he refused to be crowned king in the city where Jesus Christ had reigned. A year later, he died in the holy city. Baldwin, the treacherous lord of Edessa, rushed to fill his shoes. He didn't share his brother's theological qualms. He readily took the title King of Jerusalem. News sped back to Europe of the extraordinary success of the First Crusade. But the inspiration for 60,000 men to travel 3,000 miles, Pope Urban, died before learning that Jerusalem was back in Christian hands for the first time in 400 years. Jerusalem is less than half a mile wide. Within her walls, the Crusaders had massacred an estimated 30,000 Muslims and Jews. News of the slaughter rocked the Islamic world.
The Crusades had a very deep impact on Arab society. One, they were seen as a barbarian incursion, and stories of those Crusades are still told in cafes and in families as if they happened yesterday. This is something quite striking. And so whenever the West has invaded that region again, people say it's another crusade, which is why, after the awful events of 9/11, when the American president inadvertently, one assumes, said we now have to wage a crusade to stop this, a shiver went down the collective spine of the Islamic world, because they felt they knew what was coming.
As the crusaders reveled in victory and plotted how to consolidate their hold on the Holy Land, slowly, steadily, the Muslims prepared to strike back. It would not be long before the wrath of Islam was unleashed on the fledgling Christian kingdom of Jerusalem.